Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and welcome to Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you recognise, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. In this episode, I speak to the phenomenal Deborah Sommerin.
When I went in to care when I was about 13, that's when I would have gone into a homeless hostel for the first time. And it was a nighttime only hostel, which means, I don't know if you've ever seen The Pursuit of Happiness, but you know the way they have to like go to the hospital in the evening and they're not guaranteed in the morning, like the same bed. That it was pretty much that. So you get dropped off there at night and then in the morning you have to get out. And it was for kids as young as like 12, right? I was 13 at the time. And nobody cares where you go. No one's dropping you off to a school or anything like that. You're just out. And
where were you going?
I had nowhere to go. You're literally supposed to just wander the streets of Dublin for the day until you ring back the hostel and try and get your place that night.
Deborah, or Debbie as she's better known as, has experienced so much in her life that it was actually hard to fit it into one conversation. She was in and out of care homes from a very young age. At 13, she became homeless, and at 14, she found out she was pregnant. In this conversation, we hear about the complicated relationship she had with her mother and the reality of years spent in care. But we also hear about the people who helped her along the way to achieve more in life than she ever knew was possible. Today, she's a management consultant, a qualified chartered accountant, and the founder of Empower the Family Ireland, a non-profit that helps single parents further their education. And of course, she's also mother to Liam, who's now 13. She's just released two books, her memoir, Believing in Me, and her children's book, I Believe in You. And at only 29, this is just the beginning for her. I was trying to think as I was making my way to the studio, like, where do we begin with the conversation? Because you have so much to talk about and you've been through so much in your life. But I know the overriding feeling from reading the book, it's really a sense of overcoming and how transformative your life has been, which is so inspiring. So I'm so looking forward to getting into this conversation. Let's start with... when you came to Ireland as a kid, I think you were around 10.
Yeah, I was 10 at the time. So I moved to Ireland after my parents split up. Quite traumatizing experience, even with them splitting up, because my mum had actually kidnapped the kids essentially from school and put them on a flight to Ireland. And it was a year later that I joined them in Ireland. So I hadn't seen my siblings and I hadn't really been allowed to talk to them for a year.
But can you explain that? So you're the eldest in your family?
I'm the oldest, yeah. So I've at the time, I had two younger siblings when we lived in Nigeria. So my parents were splitting up and, you know, things didn't go very well. So at one point, we were living with my dad because my mom couldn't afford to have us live with her. And my dad wasn't giving her any money to support us. So we had to move back with my dad, which was his plan, right? Because again, in that sort of patriarchal society, that's how things happen. Mm-hmm. And then you get the wife to come back through that. But I suppose his family was also interfering and didn't want them to get back together. So that didn't make things very easy. So right. Essentially they stayed split up. My mom somehow managed to save enough money to buy plane tickets to take the kids because she knew if she stayed there, she just had no chance. So the kids were at school one day and it was weirdly a day that I had gotten really, really ill. I had really bad stomach pains. I'd gotten a really bad dose of food poisoning from these sausage rolls that are sold on the street, and I'd never eaten them before. I'd always been never want to buy them, but they're in traffic, and one day I just decided to eat them anyways. So I'd gotten really, really sick and I'd been rushed to hospital, and the kids went to school, and my mom showed up at the school, and we weren't allowed to see my mom at that time. So my dad had said, if she comes to the school, give me a call, don't let her leave with the kids. And at the time he was away in Abuja for business, which is pretty far away. You have to take a flight there essentially. It's another part of Nigeria. So anyways, she came to the school. She wouldn't leave without the kids. Obviously, the other parents had to take their children home. So eventually it wasn't sustainable to just keep her there. So she left. My dad was thinking, fine, okay, you know, she'll probably be back, you know, with the kids. But she went straight and got on a plane to Dublin. And she was actually pregnant at the time and I didn't know. So there was this gorgeous little baby that I never got to meet initially as well, which is quite sad for me.
So at this stage, your mum and your siblings are gone.
Yeah.
And you're in hospital.
Yeah. Yeah, it was horrible. It was actually horrible, especially me and my brother are Irish twins. So we spent 2 months of the year literally the same age. We were so close as kids. Yeah. I remember we'd all play Power Rangers. I'd be the yellow one. He'd be the blue one. My sister would be the pink one. You know, we were really, really close. So that was quite tough to be apart from them. And I would be lying to you if I said our relationship ever fully recovered, to be completely honest with you. And we've definitely never been as close as we were pre being separated. But I wasn't also allowed to speak to them very much during that year that they were gone. But I suppose something I think personally, that my dad just got sick of being a single dad. He wanted to be single and wanted to be able to have all the women over, and that wasn't necessarily the easiest thing when you have a 9-year-old child who very much did not want a new stepmom around. And I think he just got sick of being a single dad, and he decided to he told me we were coming here for a holiday, actually, to see my mum and dad, see my mum and my siblings. And I was delighted. I was obviously delighted to meet my little brother and see my other brother and my sister again. And then when we were here, he told me that we weren't going home. Mm. I was staying there with my mum. And of course, I was really, really happy to be with my siblings. But I was also very cautious of the fact that growing up, me and my mom had butted heads, right? And my dad had been my protector. So being hit wasn't alien to me, but the fact that my dad would generally be there to put a stop to it before it got really, really bad, that was something I was used to. So that was the thing I was worried about. But things were going really well at this point. Everything was fine. Nobody was hitting me. And so, okay, I had no choice in the matter anyways. I was staying there. That was my move to Ireland initially. We lived in Nace.
And so your dad and your mum had separated. Was he hoping that there might be some kind of a reconciliation at this point, or was it simply he was bringing you back to your mum and your...
He was bringing me back to my mum, yeah.
Okay, so that's a lot going on there, isn't there?
Yeah. Huge sense of abandonment and 100%, there's that level of abandonment with someone that you're so close to, like your closest parent. But then obviously what came later in terms of constantly moving care homes, it's very much left me with this, I never want to depend on anyone,
yeah,
you know?
Fiercely independent.
Absolutely. I always want to stand on my own 2 feet. So I suppose that's the positive out of it. But it definitely affects in terms of relationships. You know, I'm really, really terrified to date people because I'm really scared that they'll leave and I'll be really, really sad. So, yeah, it's a really interesting one. But it was positive, at least initially. But my mum, she'd been suffering with depression even before she'd moved to Ireland. She was locking herself in her room for weeks on end. So when we moved here and she was on her own, even more so, she didn't have her mum that could help with babysitting or anything. And yeah, things are very, very different over there. You very much have people that can help out. I'd always been a neighbours or something, you know. But when we were here, you don't have that sense of community anymore. You don't know people. You haven't grown up around people, and she didn't have any family around. And she had four kids, 10 and under, with her.
Yeah, yeah.
So things deteriorated massively. And she started staying in her room for weeks on end again. Just to say, it was like a special occasion if my mum picked us up from school. It was like a routine. Me and my brother and sister would drop my baby brother off at creche, and then my sister off in her class, and then we'd go off to school. So that was always the way things were.
So when you came to Ireland with your dad, was it a good surprise for your mum, or what was that reaction like when you guys were reunited?
Knowing my mum, I really feel that it was because my dad had not let me speak to her for so long. He was really, really angry with her.
Mm.
And I think that she hid her own feelings at the time. She just wanted to play nice so she could get me back, right? She wanted all of her kids. So at the time, there was no fighting between them. You know, they were very much pretending like everything was normal, and my mum very much so, and that's not like my mum at all. She does not like keep her feelings hidden.
Yeah.
Especially given, you know, she left initially because she thought my dad was disrespecting her and possibly cheating on her. So that's not something I would expect them to be super friendly about, unless my mum was trying to just play nice to get me back and make sure he didn't take me back with him.
Yeah.
And he's the sort of person that would absolutely, if she had, you know, made trouble, take me back out of spite. You know, that's just the sort of relationship that they had.
Okay.
So I do believe that she was playing nice at that time to make sure that my dad kept me here and left me here. Yeah. Yeah.
And you said that, you know, it sounds like she was really troubled. She was somebody who, I just get the feeling from what I've heard you speak of before and reading the book, that she had a lot of demons.
So many demons. Not only was she dealing with depression, which is a horrible illness, which we didn't know that much about. It's not the same now where there's like ads everywhere, and you'd know maybe from even just seeing posters, right? Someone's staying in the room all day, the way that she was behaving is going through a serious mental health issue. But she was also diagnosed with fibromyalgia. So, which is, it's essentially a disease that affects your muscles, and it's really painful.
Okay.
So she was also in like constant pain.
Physical pain as well.
Constant physical pain.
Right.
So she would sometimes have a neck brace or a cane that she would actually need to walk around with because she was in so much pain and she was taking so much medication. So she was, I think that she was trying her best,
mm-hmm.
as best as she could. I think she was an incredible person. We definitely got much closer after I had my son, which is why it upsets me so much, because if we'd left things the way things had been, where we had continued butted heads, it would have been a different feeling about it all. But because we were getting so close after I had my son, when she did pass away, it was horrible, because I just feel like we could have had a whole longer relationship. We could have had a normal mother-daughter relationship, I feel. And even this thing of my dad being my protector, to give you context of how this completely changed after I had my son, my mum was now my protector. So I'd given birth to my son, and in the hospital, I decided I was going to bottle feed, right? I was so young. I didn't really...
Zero judgment here.
Sorry, but yeah. So I'd made the decision I was going to bottle feed.
Yes.
And my dad came, my dad's very old school. My dad's like in his 80s now. So he came storming up to the hospital room, like, "You're breastfeeding that child. He's going to have brain damage if you don't breastfeed him." Like, very, very traditional nonsense.
Oh, right, okay.
And my mum was like, no, things are different now. Let her bottle feed. That's okay. And that had never happened previously where... like, yeah. My dad was the person who was giving out to me and my mum was the person who was standing up for me. So we very much learned to there was a new part of our relationship that grew, a new level of understanding. But she, at that stage, she was so sad. She was so tired. And things had happened where she, I don't really understand why, but essentially had to move back into a direct provision hostel. And I'd been living in hostels for a number of years. This is after, I think there was a change in law at some point. So people who were seeking sort of that sort of status leave to remain initially could get rent allowance, and then there was a law change and then they had to go back to direct provision. So that had been really hard for her as well, because I don't know, I think she felt like she'd failed all of us, you know. So yeah, she was someone who was going through quite a lot, and I think I carried a lot of guilt for a really long time, especially after she died, that, you know, I might have somehow contributed to that because I went into care. And felt like I brought hassle and more trouble to her life. Even though I know I wasn't safe there, and I don't know what the right thing was there, but the more I think about it, the more I just think that I wish we had some sort of family counselling or something to just help us understand each other better, so that I could go back home with my mum. I could, she could maybe look after me better. I don't know if that's possible. Maybe that's just fairy tale land and wishful thinking, but it's, you obviously wish you spent more time with your mum, you know, especially as you get older and your child grows older. You just want to have a mum that you can pick up the phone and chat to about anything. So yeah.
We've only been talking a short time, and what really strikes me about you is your scope for compassion and understanding is far greater than majority of people, I think, because when I've read what you had to endure in terms of your relationship with your mother, and I'm not here to comment. It's not my place, and it's I've zero right to do that. But after everything that you went through, and the physical aspect of your relationship, and how, you know, at times she would beat you, I suppose I would it would be understandable that there might maybe some residue there. But it seems like you just have such a massive heart, and that you feel for her so deeply in terms of everything she was dealing with. And you're still only, what, 29?
29.
There's a wisdom in you that is far beyond your years that really we all need to get better at understanding other people and their motivations, and get to that place of compassion that you clearly are at, which really is something.
I think it's one of those things where, and I was telling my little brother about this because he was upset about something. When you carry that kind of hate in your heart, nothing good comes out of it. Mm. So through years and years of therapy, that's what has come out of it, right? Is learning to try and understand somebody else's point of view, try and empathize with that person so that I'm not angry, I'm not upset. And that I'm able to try and understand where she was coming from and how she was feeling and why she treated me that way. Yeah.
Were you her punch bag?
Yeah, absolutely. She took her frustrations out on me, absolutely. I remember one time where I'd actually, my social worker was with me, and I'd gone home to pick up some clothes. And this is what I mean in terms of the frustration, you know. It was obviously really sad that she didn't have her daughter. But I was walking out the front door and she grabbed me by the hair and whacked my head off the radiator in front of the social worker. And the social worker just ran and got into her car. and I had to just try and like fight my way through and get like struggle to get out.
The social worker left.
He ran and got into the car. The social care worker did.
Whoa,
so it was just because, you know, in that instance, she was trying to, she didn't know if my mum was going to attack her too. So her instinct was to get into the car.
And
so
what age are you at this stage?
Oh, probably about 12.
Okay.
So it was, I can understand, like, for her, she was just like, why are you not staying? Like, how can you do this to me? Why are you leaving? And she didn't understand. I don't know. It just wasn't her hurting me was only going to make me not come home, you know, was only going to keep me away longer. And I think after that, things became a lot harder for my mum to be able to get me back, you know, because they'd actually witnessed it as opposed to seeing scars, you know?
Yeah. So you were in and out of foster care.
Yeah.
And in and out of care, different care environments.
Yeah. So the way that it works, well, for me and generally a lot of my other friends that I grew up with in care, like, they do try and put you back with your parents, right? It's not to, they're not trying to keep kids, take them away once and never put them back. They're always trying to put them back. But it's not that you go to family counselling, work through your issues, and they're like, oh yeah, everything's good. It's the way that I would describe it is if you're meeting like middle class standards, right? You're getting up, you're keeping the house clean, you're taking the kids to school, ticking the box, right? She's ready for you to go home, kind of thing.
Okay.
So, and I wanted to go home. You know, I didn't like being in strangers' houses. I wasn't always necessarily safe when I was in care. So I very much wanted to go home. So I'd be in a number of emergent, nobody ever knew how long I'd be in care for. So they'd get like emergency care places, which would be like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, maybe a month if I was really lucky. And nobody would tell you that. Social worker would just show up one day and ask you to pack your stuff and ask you to move. To the extent that, like, even in my own house, I'm there 11 years and there's still things I haven't unpacked. It's like I'm waiting for someone to come and say I have to move. When you really started decorating in the last couple of years, now that I just feel settled there. But anyways.
Well, I mean, God, that I would imagine that makes complete sense. When you've had that lack of stability, that lack of an anchor in your life in those key years, like, you know, you're going from being a child to being a young woman, your body is changing, you know, all the hormones that go with it, and you don't have a place to call home. You don't have a safe haven.
No, you don't even have people that you necessarily, you don't know. I remember the first time I even, just something small, like first time I got my period, you know, and I was in a new foster home and I didn't really know this woman and I didn't know what to do, didn't know how to tell her, didn't know how to ask for whatever I needed. So it's just little things like that that you, I don't know that being, like, it's definitely fantasizing it that being at home might have been a better experience, but it's obviously really sad that I didn't have someone that was familiar to me to go through that with, you know? Sorry. So yeah, so moved quite a lot and I'd go back home and then I'd go back into care again and then I'd move back home. And when I went in to care when I was about 13, that's when I would have gone into a homeless hostel for the first time. And it was a nighttime only hostel, which means, I don't know if you've ever seen The Pursuit of Happiness, but you know the way they have to like go to the hospital in the evening and they're not guaranteed in the morning, like the same bed, that it was pretty much that. So you get dropped off there at night and then in the morning you have to get out. And it was for kids as young as like 12, right? I was 13 at the time and nobody cares where you go. No one's dropping you off to a school or anything like that. You're just out. And
where were you going?
I had nowhere to go. You're literally supposed to just wander the streets of Dublin for the day until you ring back the hostel and try and get your place that night. So thankfully for me, I suppose one thing they do have is that a social worker or someone from Focus Ireland, which they essentially outsource to sometimes to support these services, someone would meet you during the day to give you like food vouchers, check you were okay, that kind of thing, if they could get a hold of you, right? So so thankfully this woman came to meet me that morning, right? Because this is my first time ever going through anything like this. And the woman is from Focus Ireland, her name was Shelley. And I don't know why. Like, I couldn't tell you why. I'm sure she'd met many kids like me, or maybe not. I don't know. But I lived in Naas up until this point. So very much coming up to Dublin was a really big deal and absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
I don't know if she sensed that in me or what it was. She was trying to, she was explaining the situation to me that, you know, she was just meeting me initially. And then in the evening, I'd need to call a hostel and things like that. I don't know if she saw that I was terrified by that concept, but she took pity on me and she let me stay in their offices during the day. And she would wait with me until I could go back to my hostel and call the hostel and secure my bed like every single night and walk me back to my hostel and pick me up every morning. Like, she had her own job and many other cases I'm sure she had to deal with. But I'm really, really thankful to her for that, because I just remember it was cold, you know, yeah. And I was really, really thankful to have somewhere warm to go.
Well, I'm only imagining now, because you're sitting in front of me as a 29-year-old woman, but as a 13-year-old girl, like, you're so young. Like, that's the age your son is now.
Yeah, which is terrifying.
It must be strange to try and imagine what you had already gone through in your life at that age. And I know from everything I've heard and how you speak about your son, like, he's your everything. You know, you're still, even though we think when we're 13 that, you know, we're so mature, but we're not. We're kids. We're still babies.
Yeah, he's my baby. I can't imagine for one second him going through anything like that, because he wouldn't even know what to do. He's just a baby.
You had to grow up so fast.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. You have to. And the way that I describe it is like you're in autopilot. You just have to keep going. I suppose, I was even saying to my brother the other day, like, if any of us had turned out to be drug addicts, I don't think anyone would blame us after everything we'd gone through, to be completely honest with you. And thankfully, somehow we've all been okay. And at different times, you know, especially after my mum passed away, I had to kind of take on a mothering role for them. I had to make sure I was looking after them. I had to make sure that they were looked after, whether it was hospital appointments or getting on to doctors or getting on to social workers to make sure that they were well cared for and the things that they needed were provided to them. I had to step up and do that. So yeah, it's definitely, you have to grow up a lot quicker. And I think to a certain extent, maybe now a bit more, as my son is getting a bit older and a little bit more independent, I'm weirdly getting to live little bits of my childhood. So like for my 24th, I had a unicorn party.
Oh, I love it.
And everyone, and I like, I've just been obsessed with unicorns, and everyone got me something unicorn themed. And no matter what it was, I loved it, you know.
Brilliant.
And everyone was on board with it. Nobody thought it was weird. Everyone thought it was cute. So
it is cute. It's good. It's adorable. And why not?
So yeah. So in a weird way, I'm finding ways to catch up on my childhood in my adulthood.
Yeah. Because you it was robbed. It was taken from you.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, at the same time, it could have gone a lot worse, is what I very much know and I'm very much aware of. And I'm so thankful to the people who looked after me and who helped me when I was in situations where it could have gone worse. Like, for example, that homeless hostel is one. But then the other example is, you know, when I was even in a different homeless hostel, then I got placed in another one that was just for girls. And I didn't want to go to school. Like, I'd be going to school, everyone's talking about their holidays to Spain, their Paul's Boutique bags, and I'm going to a place, there's bars on the windows in the kitchen is locked at a certain time, we got €2.50 pocket money, there was no sense that I could ever save up. It would take me like 100 years to save up for a Paul's Boutique bag at that time.
Yeah.
So it was depressing. I didn't want to be going to school. And this incredible woman, again, from a charity that was helping me at the time, Focus Ireland, Margaret, she set up a star chart system for me. And it was the only way you could have got me to go to school, because it was really hard it still is really frustrating to get makeup for dark skin. So you can't just go to the pharmacy and pick up something for €10. So you could only really at the time get it in like Brown Thomas under like MAC counters or Bobby Brown. They're like €35 one. So the only way you could get me to go to school, she set up a star chart. If I went to school every day for 3 months, I'd actually get a piece of my favorite makeup at the end. And that was literally the only way you could have gotten me to go to school at the time. And I'm so
smart
thankful
woman.
To her. Very smart woman.
Yeah.
I'm very thankful to her, because a lot of kids, just with all of the disruption and things like that, drop out of school and will stop going to school for maybe a year or 2 years. And by the time they're somewhere more stable, they've missed 2 years of school. So then you're talking about someone who's 14 going into sixth class, right? Which won't make much sense. Then they end up looking at alternative options, and then they don't get to finish their education. So it's something I'm very thankful to those people who did intervene at those times.
Yeah. So you're still managing to go to school, but I know you're moving all the time. You know, there's no stability. And as you said the word there, you know, I didn't always feel safe. So I'm not going to probe, but I would imagine there were situations where, you know, that feeling that that everybody's entitled to have, regardless what age they are, that feeling of sanctuary and safety in your own home. You unfortunately didn't have that.
Not always.
You didn't have that always. Then you found out you were pregnant.
Yeah. And thankfully at the time I had moved into a home where I felt safe.
Good.
In Drumcondra, and I called it Disneyland when I talked about it, not because there's anything special about it. It was just a normal house and a normal housing estate, but for a really, really long time, that was what I wanted.
Yeah.
Just a normal home. And I ended up getting pregnant when I was 14. And when you're in care, mothers and babies weren't allowed to stay in the same home as other mainstream children, right? Just individual kids in care. I'm really sorry to use the term, but it was still what they were called.
Yeah.
In the care system was,
yeah,
mother and baby homes is where kids in care who had babies had to move into.
Mm.
And I didn't really know what was going on behind the scenes, to be completely honest with you, but essentially there was nowhere for me to go. There wasn't even a mother and baby home for me to go to. But I'd also heard really scary stories about what they were like in terms of not getting any support. And the first time you screw up, your baby's taken off you, which is terrifying for a parent at any new parent at any age.
Absolutely.
You know, to feel like you're going to be under
because
a microscope.
It's so hard. But I can imagine so you were 14, I think were you 15 actually having Liam?
15 actually.
15, so come on, you're still, and with everything that you're, you know, dealing with and having to contend with, you're probably operating on are you in fight or flight a lot of the time? Am I imagining that correctly?
You're not even, you're just autopilot. Like, I can't say to you.
Did you shut off emotions a bit?
Kind of, yeah. You kind of, when people say, how did you not realize how far you'd come until years and years? I don't even know how I did it. I can't tell you how I did it because it must have been so hard to do my leaving cert with a crying baby, to do each one of my exams with a child, you know, obviously wanting attention and things like that. And then to do, you know, go into audition, work those really long hours. But I was genuinely an autopilot. I just kept going because that was what I had to do. And it was also this kind of thing of, I didn't know that I could actually do it. So I didn't really believe that I was going to become a chartered accountant. I kept thinking at some point I'm going to fail because I'm too stupid to do this. And that's going to be the end of it. But I'm going to keep trying because this is what I need to do. This is my best chance at providing a really good life for my kid. So you're just keep going and keep going and keep going because you know what the alternative could be. If I wasn't able to provide for him, if I wasn't able to get a good job and get that education. So you just keep going. That's all I can really say about it. But I definitely did not have my emotions fully turned on. I definitely didn't think about the things that had happened in my life.
It was a coping, probably.
You had to kind of shut it off.
When you say that you thought you wouldn't succeed, that it wouldn't happen, is that because that was ingrained in you, or is that simply because of the turmoil, the upheaval, the instability of your life that you felt it's not going to work out for me?
It was a combination of factors. One, I was always very weirdly focused on statistics, right? So statistics for teen single moms that were Black, didn't know a lot of them that went on to become chartered accountants, right? Especially ones that were raised in care. So that was a big thing in terms of visibility. Who the hell did I think I was? If people were doing this en masse, I would know, right?
I'm just getting so many goosebumps now because this is why it's so important that you're speaking. Because you are such a source of inspiration for so many people. And anyone listening to this conversation or anyone that needs to hear this conversation, you will become such a massive role model to them. Anyway, I didn't mean to cut across you, but that's why it's so important, because you didn't have that.
Thank you. I didn't. And I wish I did. I really, really wish. I really, really wish I had someone I could look up to and go, right, she did it.
She did it.
I can do it. You know?
Yeah.
So there was that side of things. But then there's the other side of things of... People didn't necessarily believe I could do it. My social worker didn't necessarily believe I could do it. So I really had to fight for a lot of things because they didn't think, they're like, why would we bother like supporting you in college? Because you're probably not going to be able to last anyways with a kid. Or even in school, my math teacher one day pulled me out of class when I was in fifth year and said, you should think about doing fourth year because you're probably not going to do your leaving cert because you have a kid.
No.
It didn't come from a place of malice. It came from a place of experience, and that experience biasing their views of what other people could achieve. And I suppose that's the other reason I wrote this book, which is one good adult can have a huge impact in someone's life. If I'd let that way of thinking influence me, if I wasn't able to go home and tell my social care workers what I'd heard in school and them tell me, she doesn't know what she's talking about. You can do anything you want to do if you put your mind to it, and you just have to keep going and keep going. If I hadn't had that, then that would have affected me. I would have gone, right, I should do the practical thing. This adult knows the right thing. She has experience in this space. I should do fourth year, go do LCA, something like that. Something easy, and then like go and do something easy where I can just start earning money straight away when I get a job, when I leave school. But that wouldn't have been the right thing for me and my son in the long term. I wanted to be able to provide I wanted him to need for nothing. Yeah. I wanted him to have a nice, safe environment, a nice, lovely childhood. And that's what I've been able to provide him. And I'm so, so thankful to all of the people that helped me along the way so that I could do that for him. And it's starting a new generation for us, right? Because even statistically in Ireland, if you have a parent that goes to college, you are statistically more likely to go to university. So it's just starting a new chain there. And that's very much the impact I'm hoping to have with something like this. Like when I went to college, I was one of the only kids in my class to go to college, right? I don't know of anybody else who went straight to college after I finished school. And some of my friends would actually say to me, Debbie, I feel really sorry for you having to do exams. Because for them, nobody in their family had ever gone to university before. This wasn't a path for them. Our school was beside DCU. It was something you walked through to get home. It wasn't something that they saw as being for them. You know, so it's trying to create role models in that way of saying, this is absolutely for you. All you have to do is put your mind to it. And this is what the outcome is.
Listening to you speak, it sounds like, you know, you and Liam and your family, the way it is now, is a fresh start.
Yeah.
You're letting go of the old ways.
Yeah.
The way it was done.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's no longer going to carry forward into the next generation.
Absolutely.
That's powerful.
I hope
you know,
so.
When you break the lines, because I'm fascinated by the idea and I really believe in it, this generational, ancestral behaviours that are handed down. And often we do things and we don't even know why we do things. We don't question it. And it's learned behaviours. Sometimes those behaviours are positive. Sometimes they're not. And sometimes it takes one strong person in a family to stand up against the fire and say no more. And you did that.
Yeah.
Which is powerful.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really lovely because my little brother, Solomon, he's in second year in Maynooth now. It's just really nice, you know, that I've created that for him in terms of he can absolutely do this. He's not, his future isn't determined by his circumstances. His future isn't determined by the fact that he lost his mum when he was 8 or 9 and had to grow up in care with a foster parent. It's not determined by that. It's determined by what he's seen his big sister do and what he wants to go on and do, you know? So I'm really happy that I'm creating that new environment for them. And even my son, like, he wants to be a corporate lawyer, not just a lawyer, a corporate lawyer.
Good on him.
You know, so it's really, really positive to see that effect there.
Yes.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Let's go back again. You're pregnant and you have Liam. And I know you've mentioned, you know, the people in your life that were key to, you know, you continuing your education through all this. But obviously, it's very hard to study and mind a small baby at the same time. So you did have elements of help?
So initially for the first 3 years after I had Liam, I lived in the care home. So they would actually give me like 7-8 hours of babysitting every week that I could choose to use however I wanted.
A week. Which is not a lot when you break it down per
well,
day.
Well, it was actually great. Because
okay, good on
like,
you.
So if he was up all night, he'd had his needles and I had school in the morning, right? I could actually, at 6 a.m., could you please mind him for a couple of hours so I can just at least get 2 hours sleep, right, before school. So those things, I know it's weird, but like you learn to live off 2 hours sleep with a new baby. Like that's just where you are. Or, you know, I'd say, right, I'm going to stay and do after school study. Could you please pick him up from the crash for me? Because I would have had to put him in a crash straight away after he was 3 months old. And that would be an hour of babysitting, you know, so I could stay in school and keep studying. So they made a big difference. You know, it wasn't going out every weekend. That wasn't what I was using my babysitting for. It was sleep and study. So they massively helped me. And I suppose it also was good because I had to learn how to do that by myself, because when I turned 18, the rules of being in care are you're out, right? You don't get that support anymore. So when I was living by myself, it was, he was in creche, so I had to be very smart about my creche times, right, and how I utilized that in terms of making sure I got to college early so I could study, and then staying before as much as I could to study in the library before I got home, had to cook dinner, get him to bed, everything, get him showered or bathed and into bed and all of that. In terms of nights out, it was things like that that I actually, because I really didn't like asking for help. I don't like being dependent on people. So it was never a case that like he was over in someone's house while I was studying or anything like that, unless it was his dad. His dad played a really big role actually once I moved out, which I'm very, very thankful to him for. So his dad would have taken him every second week for the weekend, which was great because then I had the weekend to study, or he'd take them at school holidays, which usually fell around the same time as like reading week in college. So again, it was great because I'd actually get to study. But aside from that, it would be my friends. So I'd literally be trying to figure out like who's not going out tonight so that they could mind him if I was going to go on a night out. But I did miss quite a lot of nights out. I missed a lot of balls. I missed the ski trip. I didn't get to do all of that stuff. Yeah. But I don't.
Not yet.
Not yet. This is it. I keep saying I'm going on Liam's leaving cert holiday with him in a few years. But, you know, it's just, I don't begrudge any of that because yeah. I love him so much. Like, he changed my life. Like, I loved spending time with him. He's an amazing child. So I was very thankful for the fact that I was getting to have an education while having a small child. So you just have to figure it out. You just have to go into autopilot and just juggle and figure it out. Definitely wasn't easy. Like, I definitely doubted myself and you know, sometimes would just be in floods of tears. And I had an incredible therapist, this woman called Sherita Berg. She was just like above and beyond. Like, I could call her at 3 a.m. having a panic attack, but the night before an exam, she'd pick up the phone.
Oh, wow.
Like, she was just incredible. And she'd also had her son when she was young and had a complicated relationship with one of her parents. So she was incredible in relating to whatever I was going through, especially after losing my mum and working through a lot of that guilt that I was carrying. She really helped me with that. So yeah, it was people like that who really, really supported me and really helped me from a mental perspective to keep going, even though I doubted myself.
Speaking of your mom, so through this time when you were in and out of care, did you see her?
Yeah, sometimes I would see her for what are called access visits. And I suppose towards the end, so the year my mom passed away, she'd had literally just a series of suicide attempts over and over and over again. And Liam was a new baby, so I'd be at school. So she was staying in, actually in hostels, not direct provisional hostels, like homeless hostels. So during the day, she generally had to leave. So she would actually come to my care home and look after Liam sometimes, like obviously with the social care workers there. She'd also cook Nigerian food for me and like freeze it and things like that. So I had like something familiar.
So she was showing you love.
So much. We had a completely different relationship after I had my son. And that's why it just hurts me so much that she didn't get to raise him more, I guess, or
be around
more. Yeah.
What age was he when she passed away?
He would have been about 1.5 at the time. And yeah, it was really, really tough because it's just, you just imagine how much pain someone has to be in, because she loved us so much. Like, we were her life. We'd been taken away. Well, I was obviously in care already and I was under a full care order at that point. But my siblings had never been, like, well, they'd been taken into care once, only for a few months previous to that, right? So they'd generally been safe. She wasn't hitting them. They were okay. But after her first suicide attempt, they were taken into care because obviously there was nobody to look after them. Because she would have been taken to hospital, and then she didn't get them back, and she would have gone into homeless hostels, and everything just kind of really spiraled from there. But I think it really hurt her that she didn't have her kids. But it was really, really difficult to just think of how much pain she must have been in, that she thought this was the only thing and this was the right thing to do, that leaving her kids was the right thing to do. That was really, really tough to sit with, because I just know how much she adored her kids, and I just think how much pain she must have been in to have gotten to that point where she thought we were better off being alone without her, or just how much pain she was in that she felt that she really this was her only option to find peace. So, yeah, I really wish that she'd gotten more of an opportunity to know her grandchildren, and I just wish she'd gotten to see the things that I got to accomplish, because she was really scared that my life was over after I had my son. I wouldn't get to accomplish things, and I wish she'd hung on a little bit longer to know things were going to be okay. And my siblings really needed her, really, really needed her. I do think that she could have gotten better, and she would have gotten them back, and I think that their lives would have been a lot different if she was there. He really, really struggled, particularly my brother, who I'm an Irish twin with. Like, he was always really, really close. It's so funny, actually. Me and my youngest brother are very like my dad, literally to the point of like our nails are the same, very much the same skin tone, everything.
Yeah.
And then my middle brother and sister, like same skin tone as my mom, have the same nails as my mom. It's the weirdest thing.
Yeah.
So they would have been the closest to my mom. Obviously my baby brother adored her as well. Like, but you know, it was really, really tough for them to lose her, because they had all been really, really close for a long time. And to a certain extent, it wasn't just me that carried a lot of guilt. They also kind of blamed me for maybe making things harder for my mum. So that was quite tough as well, to work through, because it wasn't just me blaming myself. It was them too. So that was tough. That was absolutely tough. And it's just really hard, because I try and get them to understand, like, there was no other option. Like, I wasn't safe living there. It wasn't something that I did consciously to create any hassle, but they would have known how bad things were for me. They saw it, but to a certain extent, they still think, yeah, I don't know, I could have stayed.
I'm not a therapist, so I'm not qualified to comment, but I suppose sometimes it's easier just to point the finger and say that's, you know, this person or this situation as the cause of that pain, rather than actually having a fuller view of it, which is that maybe no one was to blame. And this was just somebody who was very troubled, who perhaps didn't get the help they needed. But when people are in pain, they do things that are sometimes not right. And it's not excusing it, but, you know, I suppose you've probably worked through a lot of that in therapy. Absolutely. And fully understand that, you know, you weren't at fault and you weren't to blame. So you're a young mother and you're trying to keep the education going. You're trying to raise your son and you're grieving the death of your mother.
Yeah.
That's an awful lot to deal with.
Well, I had my leaving cert. I really don't think that, especially initially, I was sad for a little bit, but then I just was like, you know what? I'm just going to focus on being busy. And to the extent that, like, I really don't think that I grieved properly after I lost my mum. So this really funny thing happened when I was actually years later, when I was doing my accounting exams. You get like huge amounts of study leave. And when I'd go for these big long walks to clear my head, I'd just start sobbing.
Okay.
Because I'd start thinking about my mum.
Yeah.
And it was like the first time I was actually sitting still, because I was always go, go, go. And I'd never had, I think you get like 3 months of study leave, right? So I'd never had that much time to stay still. College, you get like 2 weeks tops for exams. So I was always go, go, go. And I don't know, it was just my first chance to really sit still. And I don't know, it just really hit me. So yeah, it was, I think I've very much used being busy with studying as a bit of a or work as a bit of a safe haven, especially initially. But I had to work through that, and I had to,
and as you said, it was the autopilot. It's just to keep on going and kind of put things in boxes and shut down your emotions just to survive.
Exactly.
And your priority, I suppose, was now this small baby that needed your attention.
Yeah, because nobody else is going to provide that life for him. Like, his dad's great, but he was never going to be the primary breadwinner, you know, and that was very clear to me, that if I wanted to give him the best of everything, that would need to be me that was providing that. So I had this human being that was depending on me, and I had to make sure he was okay. So that was 100% my priority.
We've touched on a lot of the dark, the difficult, and the traumatic relationship that you had with your mother. What are the memories that stand out that are good that you have of her? Which one like comes to mind when you think of a moment between you guys? Because you spoke about her coming around and showing love by making Nigerian food and providing and helping for you that way, and being your voice, helping you when it came to choice to breastfeed or to bottle feed. Did she struggle to tell you how she felt?
I don't think that she, because I don't think that she struggled to show that emotion to my siblings. I remember a few years ago, like, actually asking my granny, like, did my mom hate me? I know we got really close towards the end, but it was growing up initially, she was so caring and compassionate to my siblings. You know, they had a completely different relationship than I would have had with my mom, and I just didn't understand why. So I think initially that was how I felt, but us being able, her then looking after me and coming over and making food and sticking up for me with my dad and trying to care for Liam. Those are the happy memories. And there's little things. It wasn't all horrible, you know. There were little things where I remember one day coming home from school and I was the first person in my class to wear a bra, and when we were in primary school and people had been making fun of my name and saying the bra, so like,
right.
And I told my mom, and she was like, tell them to look at your mom has big boobs, it's not your fault, you know. So like little things like that, and you know, her teaching me to put on gold makeup, which I still wear to this day, like gold eyeshadow. So there's little things like that where we did have moments that we were happy, but generally I felt like I wasn't wanted. before I would have, and even after I had Liam, you know, I very much, I don't know, maybe the pessimistic side of me, understand that. I think a lot of the reason she was supportive of me getting pregnant, initially she was really mad at me. She wouldn't let me talk to my siblings, like was really, really upset with me. But it was like once she found out that Liam's dad was Irish, there was a complete 180. And now I understand that it's because there's different rules for children who are born here. If one of their parents are Irish, they're automatically entitled to citizenship, as opposed to the situation they were kind of in a limbo for a number of years. That
right.
improved her chances of being able to stay.
Okay.
So the pessimistic side of me is kind of going, right, is that why we got to have a really good relationship? I don't think it's why she would have done all the things that she did. I think it was, there is a genuine part of that in terms of us getting closer, but it's just a really weird one.
In therapy, what have you unraveled? Where are you at with it now in terms of what you think?
I think that we were very similar.
Okay.
And I think that she had a perception of what I should be like based on what she was like as a child. And I talk about that in the book. She's very, she was a good girl, you know, she did what her mum told her all the time. As opposed to when I moved here, I'd had like a really sheltered upbringing, like Sunday school all the time. All our books were Bible books. I wasn't allowed to watch Sabrina the Teenage Witch, like because it was witches. So very, very sheltered. So when I moved over here, it was very much pushing the boundaries. You know, I was very much rebelling, and I completely own up to that. And I think, and even beforehand, you know, even within that sheltered upbringing, I still tried to, I don't know, somehow speak for myself. Not to the same extent, definitely, but you know, she'd say, eat cornflakes. And I'd be like, no, I really want Rice Krispies. As opposed to my siblings would just eat the cornflakes, you know? So there was, and that would be one thing I would, like, that's one argument I remember us getting into where she completely lost it before breakfast and just really beat the shit out of me. And my dad had to come and step in. And this is all before school.
Over cereal.
Over cereal, right? So it's like okay. little things like that of being stubborn. And when I say it was being similar, I think while my mum wouldn't have treated her mum that way, I think from a, she was stubborn. She wouldn't have moved here if she didn't have this wanting to do things differently than just staying in a marriage that she was unhappy in, you know?
That. And why did she choose Ireland?
I've absolutely no idea.
Okay.
Couldn't tell you for all the money in the world.
Yeah.
She never shared that with me. And I didn't even, to be completely honest, even though I'd lived in England, I was born in England, I'm not going to lie to you, I didn't really know much about Ireland, you know? So
yeah. We didn't even talk about that. Yeah, you were born in London.
Yeah. So...
So you moved around a fair bit, really?
Yeah, we were like to the extent that I was born in London, my brother was born in Nigeria, then my sister was born in London. So we yeah. were just constantly moving between the two countries, which was also a really interesting thing for me growing up because I was never like fully immersed in Nigerian culture. So I couldn't, like most places, most people I interacted with spoke English, but obviously there was also a language there and
yeah,
there's different
yeah.
languages and different tribes, so I don't know how to speak Yoruba.
Okay.
And it was always this thing of you're kind of different because you don't properly speak those languages.
So did you feel like you didn't fit in anywhere?
Really? Yeah, but definitely felt more that I fit in. I think I definitely felt more that I fit in when I was with people who at least look like me, you know.
Okay.
And I think here it was a different experience because when we first moved to Nace, there was not really many black families in Nace.
Yeah.
And certainly there was no other black kids in my class. So it was an interesting one, not only for me, but for the kids there as well, because this was one of their first times interacting with someone that was a person of color. So they would make fun of things like how big my lips were and things like that, which again is just a characteristic of being a black woman. And for years I hated that. I would actually like suck in my lips to try and make them look smaller. So it's like as I've grown up and as I've gone to therapy that I've learned to unwind those things and I've learned to embrace who I am.
Yeah.
But it's little things. Like I remember we would be, you know, hanging out and someone would be saying, this was at the time when everything was like, don't like immigrants, they're coming over here and stealing our jobs and blah, blah, blah. So my friends were picking this up probably from the kitchen table or whatever and saying it. And then they turn around and be like, oh shit, Debbie, I didn't realize you were there. We don't mean you. Oh. It's about the other people, you know? So then this thing came in my head of like, I need to make sure I do as much as possible to not make them dislike me, to want to be liked, to the extent that I very much...
were people pleasing.
Absolutely. And as much as possible, try to disassociate myself from things that were stereotypically black, you know?
Right, okay.
And didn't even very much... shied away from even having black friends, because it was like, if I'm with black people, it becomes even more heightened in my that I'm black. I don't know, in my head that made sense. And even talking to my friends who've also grown up here and grown up in different parts of Ireland, they weirdly had the same feeling and experience.
Right.
And it's beautiful to see things there like black and Irish, where you're embracing both sides of your culture. But it just wasn't like that when we were initially growing up. It wasn't. It just felt like something that would make you more alienated and more different and make you not want to have friends. And that was very much my experience initially when I moved here, because I didn't realize that difference was a bad thing. So I didn't really have friends initially when I moved to Nice.
And it isn't a bad thing, but I suppose it was, yeah.
It was, yeah, in my head.
It's changed, but I would imagine it still has a long way to go.
I think things are definitely a lot better, but even my son Liam was getting bullied in school when he was in fourth class. And I, like, to the extent that the school, this kid had said the N-word a couple times, and the teacher called me up and was like, yeah, this is offensive to you. And I'm like, this should be offensive to
everyone.
So they didn't deal with it properly, and I just took him out of the school and I put him in an international school, and he's been so settled, because it was really impacting his own sense of self-worth, how he saw himself as he was growing up and becoming more self-aware. And to the extent that, like, he'd always had this really cool, like, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air haircut, and he was like, no, I just want it normal.
Okay.
So it was really, really affecting him. And I didn't want that from... I didn't want him to go through what I'd gone through, right? Yeah, I didn't want him to like think of himself. I wanted him to grow up and embrace who he was. And since he's been in international school, he's a completely different child. He's so happy. Like, he's so settled and he's so okay with being different, to the extent that he did a whole project about like Nigeria and the history of Nigeria and everything. So, and it was like begging me to make jollof rice, which is like a traditional Nigerian meal, to bring into school. So it's just, that's what I want for him. That's what I want for him, is to grow up in that environment where he feels included.
Yes. And own his heritage.
Absolutely. Owns who he is.
Yeah. So if I was to ask you who are you? Like, what would you describe yourself as now?
Oh God. I would say that I'm someone who is a mother first. Very much so, trying to make sure that my teenage son comes out something like Ryan Gosling in the Notebook, and is a really lovely, lovely, lovely young man.
Love that.
I'm very ambitious from a career perspective. I think that's just a drive that is in me, because I feel like I just really want to succeed. So I very much, my priorities are work and Liam first, but work next. My friends are very important to me. Yeah, it's a difficult one. I think I'm just trying to live my life and trying to do things that make me happy and trying to do things that move me forward. And I hope that it all leads to me having the level of success that I hope that I have in my career. Having an amazing child that I'm proud of, who treats people with kindness and empathy, which he does, which I love. I just want him to keep that. Mm-hmm. Trying to be a really good sister to my siblings and be there for them as much as they need me, and similarly for my friends. And especially with the charity, like, that's a really big thing for me, is creating something where other people can go on to university and have the things that would stop them if they didn't have as little money as they did, trying to get those things removed out of their way, those barriers removed out of the way around accommodation and childcare. And it's really interesting that we've obviously had that cost of living protest over the weekend, because what you heard resoundingly from students, even without children, is that it's difficult for them to find accommodation. So it's trying to give back in some way.
Let's talk about it now, because we actually haven't mentioned it yet. Your charity is Empower the Family. And just to mention as well that in 2020, you were listed on the Forbes 30 Under 30 in Europe, making your nonprofit the only Irish female-led establishment to be featured that year. That's huge.
Thank you.
Well done. Thank Massive you. Congratulations. I mean, what you have done so far in terms of succeeding in education and your career and what you're doing, but also with this, that is such a passion project for you. So just explain to people as well what your ultimate aim is, because as you said, we're hearing about it all the time. You know, people are struggling to do the weekly shop to make sure that their kids have breakfast in the morning before they go out to school. People are not able to go. They're staying and they're commuting, like they're living at home with their folks and they're commuting to college. They're doing things that are really in this day and age shouldn't be happening. It's outrageous. But you're doing something and your aim is to really, really help where it matters.
Absolutely. So the whole vision is essentially to provide housing specifically for single parents and young people coming out of state care who generally have issues either progressing to university or staying in university because of a lack of accommodation and a lack of childcare, right? We want to fundamentally provide that sort of housing for anyone that can't afford to go to university, specifically for people on access programs, right? But we're trying to do that prioritization based on the people who are most at risk of homelessness, which are single parents and young people coming out of state care. So that's how that prioritization has worked. So we've been working with Dublin City Council to acquire a site in Ballymun. So we have to do a presentation to the councillors now to hopefully they'll vote to dispose the site to us. We've done a huge amount of work on the site in terms of architects and due diligence, and we actually have a 3D model already of what the site would look like. And it is 20 apartments for single moms. They're two bedrooms each. I've even designed them in terms of, because I was always cautious that when I was studying for exams, I was worried I was going to be done for child endangerment just because Liam was in the sitting room and I was in the kitchen and I couldn't always see him, you know, when I was studying. Yeah, yeah. So I was always, it's just something I was always worried about. I'm like, I hope he's okay. He was always okay, of course.
Sure.
But, and it was obviously when he was at an age where it was okay to leave him on his own. But still, it was just things like that in terms of how I design the space so that you can be studying and still be able to keep an eye on your kid and you're happy enough in that. So that's 20 of those apartments, and then 14 one-bedroom apartments, which will specifically be for young people coming out of state care. And if for some crazy reason there aren't enough students in college that meet those two categories, then we just offer it to other people who are on access programs who can't afford university.
Yeah.
So they won't go to waste. And there'll also be a creche there. Again, really easy for single moms. Drop your kids a creche, go off to college, you know, have that sorted out and make sure that it's affordable, right? And in their locality. And then the other thing being a community center. So we want to obviously give something back to the community as well. So there is a organization called Young Ballymun that are based in the Access Center right now, and they want to expand their services, but there's nowhere else for them to go. There isn't another Access Center. They can't build an additional area to the Access Center. So they'll actually be relocating into our building. We'll have a purpose-built space for them. And that means they'll be able to provide childhood-based initiatives to people in the community. And then in the evenings, what we would love to do as well is partner with one of the community development projects to actually expand their homework club services, because particularly for a lot of kids in areas like that, those homework clubs are the only chance they might get to get a proper hot meal, right? So we very much things like that, or just things that are around positive association with education for children as young as possible, is very much the aim of that development, and making a difference for generations to come. Because we say we're not only making a difference in a single parent's life by removing the barriers to education for them, we're making a difference in a child's life by putting them in an environment with a positive association with education from a young age, which again, research shows has a big difference, particularly for people who come from disadvantaged backgrounds, in their later educational attainment. But then we're also making a difference in the community by creating role models with those single parents and children. We're creating role models for other people to go to college and say, yeah, actually, I know Sarah from down the road. She's now doing really well for herself. That's actually an option for me. Not going off and doing a PLC course, not going off and because that's easier. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's just to be able to see that you could actually have a much higher income and a much higher, better way of life if you're able to go to college. So where people are able for that, where people are determined to do that, we should absolutely try and support them to go on and do that, because at the end of the day, they're much better off in terms of standing on their own two feet in the long run, especially with the way that things are right now.
When you were a 13-year-old girl, if you could have had a glimpse into the future of the, you know, 29-year-old you sitting here having a conversation after releasing your own book, books actually, because it's not just this one, but it's the children's book that you've written as well. Would it have blown your mind?
Yes. Very, very surreal. But there's also this really weird thing that I used to tell myself whenever things got really, really bad, when I was like really, really, really upset and didn't understand what was happening. I just say, like, I just comfort myself by saying this is just another chapter in my book.
Wow.
So it's a really, like, and I didn't even go seeking to write this book. Like, Gil rang me, you know, it wasn't something I was seeking to, it wasn't something I planned to do, but it was just something that I comforted myself in saying, this is just another chapter, you know, to just try and get myself to move forward and realize whatever had happened didn't need to determine the rest of my life, didn't determine how I reacted. I could think about how I would figure out a way out of whatever I was dealing with at the time. And an example of that would be, you know, going to college. And at the time, you weren't allowed to get rent allowance if you were a single mom and you were in college. So I was told to go and sit on the dole essentially for 5 years before I could, 3 to 5 years before I could actually go to university. My problem was I'd stayed in school, quote unquote, from the social welfare officer I'd went to see. So I had to really fight for funding through TUSLA then to be able to have rent and have childcare. And initially, you know, it's really, really hard to get additional funding for things like that. And at the time, the aftercare, I suppose, legislation was very much could support, but like didn't really put a statutory obligation on TUSLA to support kids in care, which it does now, which is great. So I had to ring up Teen Parent Support Programme, the One Family, counselling people, Focus Ireland again. I literally put together a like team of lobbyists to like write letters to the CEOs of the organisation to beg for that funding for me. And that was how I was able to do that. And I was 17, but I knew I had to do that, you know? So it's just little things like that where it seemed like hopeless that I was doing all of this work for a Leaving Cert to go to college and not even going to get to go to college. I'm not going to be able to afford to go to college, but you kind of just have to figure out a way to cry about it and then go, right, what am I going to do about it? How am I going to move on? That was just one chapter. I'm going to move on to the next one and try and make it more positive. Yeah.
You're incredible. Would you ever go into politics?
Absolutely not.
Oh, you didn't even have to think about that. But you just seem to me like, you know, already, why? Why not? No interest.
Definitely have an interest. I just think, and I think it's a lot of the things that we hear, obviously, about it being really hard for women and really difficult, and especially for, you know, women of colour. You know, I've definitely seen things that happen to people like Ellie Kasumbe, who I was devastated by, right? And then Hazel Chu gets so much abuse and she's incredible. So it's things like that that obviously...
Yeah, do you want to be putting yourself up for that,
I suppose? Why would you do that, you know?
I get the point. So is it 11 years you're in your house?
Yes, yeah.
And you still have some boxes to unpack?
Yeah.
Will you eventually unpack them, do you think?
Yeah, I will. Well, I'm slowly... In the last couple of years, we have been... And we've actually started, like, kind of redecorating and stuff as well, just trying to make it our own. Because obviously at this point, it's kind of settling in that I'm going to be there for now anyways, hopefully. But yeah, so I feel really settled there. The thing is, when I was moving out, I would have gone on one of the mommy blogs and was like, oh, looking for recommendations of a creche and blah, blah, blah. And someone recommended the creche in my area, which was pretty far away from where I lived at the time. But I was like, again, best thing for Liam. So I would actually... The area was in Clongriffin, Northern Cross. I was obviously going to college in DCU and I lived in Drumcondra. So I'd have to get a bus, like two buses, to get him from Drumcondra to creche and then get another two buses to get to college, but it was the best thing for him. And I remember waiting for the bus one day and looking at the estate and thinking, oh God, I wish I could get a house there. Like one day, I really, really hope to be able to move in there. But I, based on my price bracket at the time, I knew I'd probably only be able to get like a small apartment. But weirdly enough, it was around the time of the recession. So one actually came up in my price bracket and literally gave her the deposit like on the spot brilliant. When I went to the viewing. So being able to give Liam this like nice childhood, like when we moved in, the kids all put like little notes like welcome to the estate, Liam, in our post box. It was really, really cute. So it's really nice to be able to grow up in an environment like that for him, just really stable and a nice environment like that. So yeah, I'm very settled there, I'm very happy there, but it's just my own internal thing of like going, you could still just have to move at short notice. I don't know, that prevented me from unpacking for a long while, I guess. But yeah, We are getting there. Those boxes are slowly, the remaining boxes are slowly getting unpacked, and I'll find things. I'm like, oh, this is really lovely from years ago.
It's an overused term, but it's one that really, really suits you. You are a true inspiration. You're a gorgeous human being inside and out. It's been an absolute joy to meet you in person. Your story is incredible. What you have been through and how you have excelled when everything was going against you at different points in your life. This book is beautiful. It's called Believing in Me. It's really important. Thank you for taking time to be here today to have this really powerful conversation.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
The amazing Debbie Somerin. Next week, I chat to Cork powerhouse Lyra. And if you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends, family or on social media. And you can support what I do in all the usual ways by clicking follow, giving a rating or leaving a little comment. Thank you so much. You've been listening to Ready to Be Real.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you're concerned about mental health or looking to get into self-improvement, join me at the Piece by Piece podcast. There, I'm interviewing everyday people and experts alike about how to overcome difficulties around mental health. Speaking of which, I just released an interview with a mental health historian and another with two friends who are healthcare workers.
If these conversations interest you, check us out at Piece by Piece. That's Peace with an A, B-I, and then Peace with an I. Thank you so much.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.